From the business desk at State Broadcast News, this is the CRE News Hour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. In this week's edition of the CRE News Hour, we'll speak with David Allison. His pioneering work on a database called Value Graphics could change the way developers look at demographics when they're targeting the markets for their real estate projects. We'll hear from JLL Executive Vice President Andrew Dickey about the hospitality sector in Puerto Rico, which is more robust than you might have thought. And we'll have a conversation with Heidi Burkhart, who founded her woman-owned real estate development and brokerage company in New York when she was just 26 years old. We'll be back with the top CRE news stories right after these messages.
Turn your podcasting passion into profits. The book, The Business of Podcasting, describes the business side of podcasting, including how to become a professional podcaster. You'll learn about positioning your clients' expertise through podcasting, too, plus the best business models, how to find clients, and much more. Visit thebusinessofpodcasting.com.
Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. Lots to do this week on the CRE News Hour, so let's get right with it with our regular roundup of the news and headlines. River Edge at Garfield, a newly constructed 104-unit luxury apartment, has come online for sale. Cushman & Wakefield is representing the seller in marketing the property, which offers the benefits of urban living in a suburban setting. Brian Whitmer of Cushman & Wakefield is leading up the marketing efforts.
It has what investors are looking for, such as the Bergen County location that is highly competition constrained. It is new construction and has one of the best amenity packages in the area. There is also the ability to drive revenue through continued enhancements, such as adding amenities.
River Edge was built in 2017. It's currently 98% leased. It consists of 2 four-story residential buildings over covered parking. Home 365 is shaking up the Las Vegas property management industry with an innovative property management technology that's intended to improve the landlord-tenant arena in a way that's unmatched by the traditional property management model. The company bundles a multitude of services for a single fee, including management fees, repairs, maintenance, tenant placement, and rent loss due to vacancies. Daniel Shaked, the founder and CEO of Home 365, created the new data and artificial intelligence-based model to provide a solution for ongoing issues between traditional property managers, property owners, and tenants.
We are leveraging data science and artificial intelligence in order to be able to predict various events for a specific property. We aggregate quite a bit of information about a specific property, like age, size, location, last time it was renovated, other aspects of the property. And we are able to crunch this data and predict various events that will happen most probably in the future. This allows us to price our service, which is all-inclusive management, in one flat predictable rate, which reduces quite a bit of risk for the property owners, makes their investment super predictable and hassle-free.
One unique aspect of the service is Home 365's guarantee to cover rent for vacant properties of up to 1 year and a tenant management program to screen and place renters. The company entered the Las Vegas market in June, and it's currently providing its services to 300 properties in the Las Vegas Valley following the acquisition of Pangea Realty and Property Management. You can get more information at home365.co. Now let's look at some headlines from the CRE world. Legal & General's formed a partnership with Oxford University to develop homes for university staff and students. Legal & General's Future Cities business will provide up to £4 billion of funding over the next 10 years for a series of projects for the university, including the development of new homes for university staff and students, and the creation of science and innovation districts with modern workspace and research facilities. Endurance Real Estate Group and DWS Group acquired a 28-acre parcel in York County, Pennsylvania. They're planning to build a 352,000-square-foot bulk warehouse on the site. Point B, an integrated management consulting, digital studio, venture investment, and real estate firm, has completed development work on St. Charles Health System's new patient tower in Bend, Oregon. The tower, which opened on May 19th, includes a 24-bed intensive care unit and a 28-bed progressive care unit, and more than 20,000 square feet of usable space for future development. Jim Dobleski will join CBRE on July 15th as Global President of Project Management. Dobleski was with JLL for 17 years, most recently as Global Head of Enterprise Sales for JLL's Corporate Solutions business. Liberty Property Trust named Sean Newman Secretary and General Counsel starting July 1st. Newman will succeed Herman Falla, who will remain with the company as Senior VP and Senior Legal Advisor. Newman is currently Liberty's Senior VP and Deputy General Counsel. He joined the company in 2012 as an Associate Real Estate Counsel. Before Liberty, he was a member of the Real Estate Practice Group at the law firm Cozen O'Connor. HFF has arranged a $13.25 million refinancing for Soma, a 69-unit luxury apartment community in Somerville, New Jersey. HFF represented the borrower, Sterling Properties Group, and got the long-term fixed-rate financing from New York Life Insurance Company. You're listening to the CRE News Hour from StateBroadcastNews.com. In suburbs across North America, shopping malls with large outdoor parking lots are being redesigned and revitalized. The parking is moved, in some cases underground, and the land is repurposed for residential condominium towers and apartment blocks adjacent to an upgraded mall that's sometimes completely rebuilt with more stores and more floors. Main streets through the complex serve as mini town centers with offices, restaurants and shops, parks and outdoor spaces dot the property, making life in these new clusters of mixed-use buildings walkable with a touch of green. When you add fitness centers, medical clinics, schools and other amenities, people of all ages can live, work, learn and play without ever leaving these vertical villages. In a new report, David Allison of Vancouver, British Columbia, is identifying the prospect audience for these mixed-use, what he calls vertical villages. The report is called When Shopping Centers Become Vertical Villages, and it looks at the growing trend of shopping centers transforming themselves into mixed-use residential communities to come up with the profile for the kinds of people predisposed to the idea of living in a vertical village. David used the 100,000 survey value graphics database to extrapolate profiles of people most likely to live in these remade communities. David, thanks for joining us on the CRE News Hour.
I'm really glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So you talk about the value graphics research that you do as providing breakthrough audience engagement. Talk a little bit about what that means, and also how did you arrive at this, what you call a proprietary predictive behavior database? And then we'll talk a little bit more about shopping centers.
Well, I guess the origin story is really very specific to the real estate development industry. I had my own marketing and strategy firm for years and years and years, and I'd always written books and tried to find things to talk about that my clients in the real estate development industry would find interesting. And so I sold my firm about 4 years ago now, and I was getting ready to write my next book. And my previous book had been about baby boomers moving out of the suburbs out of their single family homes into more stacked urban environments. We called it the stackable boomer. And so I had baby boomers on the brain. It was that moment in time when we couldn't do anything except read about millennials, millennials this, millennials that, millennials are ruining everything. And it seemed to me that these were kind of the same people. The stories I was reading that the millennials, what they want, what they need, what they expect out of their lives were the same things that the boomers had told me. And I thought that was really, really curious. So I called the research team I'd worked with for my previous books, and I said, listen, I have this hunch that age isn't really all that important. And can we maybe just go out and figure out what's going on around this, specifically as it relates to real estate developments, because we build buildings particularly around age groups. This building's for boomers, this one's for first-time homebuyers, this one's for millennials, whatever. And the data started to come back, and it was pretty loud and clear right from the beginning. Two things. First, no one wants to live in a building full of people the same age. And second, they would pay as much as 15% more than market value for their condo or their apartment than if they, than they would otherwise, as long as they knew one thing, that the values of the people in the building matched theirs. So it became very clear very quickly that values were an incredibly powerful tool, more powerful than demographics. So we started to do even more research. We got to 40,000 surveys when we started to see that this applied to everything in the world. B2B, B2C, it doesn't really matter what. If you understand your audience based on what they value, you can be as much as 8 times more impactful in the way you engage with them, in the way you can influence them, in the way you can get them to pay attention to what you'd like them to pay attention to. And it works in B2B as easily as it does in B2C.
So how does this apply to shopping centers? Your research is when shopping centers become vertical villages, and we're now seeing these vertical stacks, as you call them, mixed-use residential communities that have retail and living space and sometimes even office space, I guess.
Yeah, it's a confluence of a whole lot of different things. First off, let's talk about this trend in the real estate industry. You know, shopping centers all over North America are struggling a little bit. They're trying to figure out how to be relevant in a changing world where online retail is taking a big, eating a big part of their lunch, and Main Street is having a bit of a resurgence, and all kinds of things are competing with shopping centers as a way for people to get the things that they need. But when you look at a shopping center, just take a step back. It's a really great piece of huge land with a large acreage of parking, surface level parking, and then a shopping center in the center. So what's happening, we're seeing this all over North America, is people saying to themselves, what if we put a bunch of residential here, rebuilt this shopping center, take that parking, put it underground, let's add some office, let's add some theaters, let's add some restaurants, maybe some apartments and some condos. Let's see if we can't build what I'm calling a vertical village and use this amazing piece of land in this great location in a way that really packs in some density and creates a sense of community and an opportunity for a whole lot of people to live and work and play in the same place. So that's happening. And we were very curious about who was coming to live at the mall. So we went and used our methodology where we find a group of people who say that this sounds very, very interesting to them. We ask them a few quick questions. And then we dive into our benchmark study, which at the moment for North America alone is 100,000 surveys deep across 380 different metrics about what people value and want and need and expect. So this is an amazingly deep, rich, robust data set. And based on those few answers from those few folks who said that they're interested in the idea of coming to live at the mall, we were able to break them up into various audiences, various profiles, and now we can help developers and anybody who's interested and say, here's who's coming. So why don't you make decisions about how to build and plan and design this place so that you're impacting the values of these folks and you'll be 8 times more effective in getting them to pay attention to what you'd like them to do, whether it's lease an office or buy a condo or rent an apartment.
So you break the audience down into 4 profiles. Can you give us a capsule description of each one?
Yeah, sure. There's actually 5 different categories of people, but one group we call the splinter groups. And that whole group it's kind of a catch-all for all these tiny little groups of everybody who doesn't fit into one of the other big 4 ones that are worth paying attention to. So we just kind of discount those guys out of the mix, because they're just too small to pay attention to. But what remains are 4 very interesting groups. The largest by far is a group that we call the local experience chasers. Now, these folks are super interested in change. They never want to do the same thing twice. There are the people who will rather go to the new restaurant than an old favorite restaurant where they have a favorite booth and a favorite thing on the menu. Maybe they have a favorite pair of jeans, and as soon as that pair of jeans wears out, they're going to try another kind of jeans because maybe it's better than the ones that they've got right now. So they're always looking for the next thing because it might be better than the thing they have right at the moment. So for them, this notion, this is 32% of the people who want to come and live at the mall. what they're really interested in and motivated by is this notion of changing experiences. So when you're programming the mall, one of the things you need to be doing to attract this 32% of the market is to say it's not going to be the same thing over and over and over. It's going to be constantly changing. There'll always be something new to keep your interest and keep you excited. They're also very motivated by things like relationships, belonging, and personal growth. So educational opportunities for these guys will be huge. The opportunity to meet other folks who are also living at the mall in this new vertical village. Those are the sorts of things that will get them to do what you'd like them to do, which in this case is come live at the mall. Far more important than the demographic stereotypes that we may have used in the past, where we said to ourselves, we think it's going to be, a mixture of men and women, probably skewing towards guys, and they're going to have an income of X, and they're going to be this old, and all those kinds of things are irrelevant. This group, the local experience chasers, cuts across all demographic audiences for this particular offering. Very quickly, the other three groups, which aren't as big, I'm not going to spend as much time talking about them. One of them is called the workaholic investors. It's about 19% of the market. They're interested in, as their name might suggest, workaholic investors. They work a lot. They're telling us they work about 80 hours a week, and they're super motivated. Their values are financial security, possessions, wealth, upward mobility. So for them, the whole idea of coming to live here is about status. It's about status. Who else is going to be living here will be very important to them. The way this place is portrayed in advanced materials, where you're trying to get somebody to come and buy a condo or lease space or get their offices here, this needs to feel like a very upscale place for that 19% of the market. Now, I've seen some examples, just to dwell on this for 2 seconds longer, where these vertical villages, as they're being planned and marketed and sold, it's all they're doing is saying, this place is super upscale, very statusy. It's going to be a great place for you. And so they're talking to this group, but they're not saying the things that will attract the other groups. So they're really limiting themselves to just that 19% of the market. Moving on to the other two, one's called the Creative Savers Society. These are folks who, 16% of the market, by the way, these are folks who see themselves as really being very, very creative. They're motivated. Their primary values are things like creativity, personal growth. Also very motivated. One of their key personal responsibilities, one of their key values is personal responsibility, which is a rare value we don't see a lot of times. So these folks really believe that they're what happens to them in their world and in their day and in their life is their own responsibility to look after that. They are saving their money is a great example. The name of this group, the Creative Savers, they save their money in order to be more creative. They will do without things in order to fuel whatever their creative passion might be. So they're very, very focused on their own creativity. And the last group, 15% of the market, are what we call the city-loving environmentalists. These folks, their core values are family, personal responsibility. There's that thing again, very odd to see it come up in two different groups for one kind of product, health and welfare, and personal growth. So for the city loving environmentalists, one of the little factoids I can tell you about these folks is they believe that the environmental issues that the planet is facing right now are very much an individual responsibility to fix. They don't think politicians or governments or large-scale groups are going to make any kind of impact whatsoever. It's all about what their day-to-day activities might be that can help reduce their own carbon footprint. That's how we're going to get ourselves out of this environmental pickle that we seem to be in as far as they're concerned. So for them, what's interesting about this vertical village concept is they see it as being a very environmentally friendly way to live. They understand that density is a good thing for the planet, and that by lots of us being in a very small square footage, a small space, instead of being sprawled out in single family homes, we're sharing resources, we're walking more than we would be using cars. They love the idea of coming to live in one of these kinds of communities because they just see it as their way of contributing to what they understand to be an environmental crisis.
I think what's most interesting about the research and the way you break these groups out is how the experience chasers seem to be the dominant preference, the dominant set of values that people are looking for something new. Did people just live in the suburbs for too long? What do you think is driving that seeking out the new experience?
Well, it's important to understand that these values profiles that we extrapolate from the data set, they don't just apply to one product or another. There's a large number of people in the world who that's how they make their decisions about everything all day long. It's not just about this particular thing. In fact, what we call in my book, which is all about value graphics, this data set we've built, the Adventure Club is one of the top 10 most powerful and most aligned archetypes for value graphic profiling that exists out of the 100,000 surveys that we have for North America. These are folks who just, that's the way they live their lives. We all know this guy, right? I mean, he or she has probably had a series of relationships because that next relationship might be the fun one. They're always out doing stuff because what they're doing right now might not be as fun as that thing they might go do later. That's just the way they live their lives. And the point of our research is that is a far, far more powerful way to target your messages, your product design, whatever it is you're trying to do to attract an audience of people. If you understand these value graphic archetypes and the personal profiles around the people that fit into them, you're going to be 8 times more effective than if you do what you're doing now, which is probably figuring out a demographic profile for your target audience and then using demographic stereotypes to try and make your decisions about what are you building and how are you going to put it together. So normally we sit around in a boardroom and we say to each other, well, gee, our target audience is 18 to 24 year old men with a household income of $35,000 a year. And so they're going to like technology. Well, in fact, we find that there are people who like technology of all ages, all incomes, both genders, all education levels, and people who are afraid of technology of all ages, all incomes, both genders, all education levels. That the demographic stereotyping that we're using to build and make decisions about everything in our world is so flawed that it's just negligible to continue thinking about demographics as a way to motivate an audience.
So the commercial real estate industry is not known for being on the cutting edge of adopting new techniques and new approaches to dealing with problems that they're comfortable with. And they tend to be comfortable with dealing with the problem in much the way that you describe. How do you get them to adopt this value graphics approach? And what kind of initial feedback have you had from them about it?
Well, it's not that difficult once I can have a quick moment to chat. I'll give you a couple of quick stats that will show you just how much of a margin of difference we're talking about here. And the commercial real estate world and all kinds of worlds are very interested in facts. So first off, with those 100,000 surveys we have in this data set and the 380 different things we've measured, values, wants, needs, and expectations, this data has a plus or minus 3.5% margin of error and a 95% level of confidence, all of which just means that it's far more rigorous than you'd need for a PhD from Harvard. So this stuff is bulletproof. So I'm going to pull a couple of just quick stats here to tell you how different it is to look at things demographically than it is to look at things valuographically. So across those 100,000 surveys and 380 different metrics that we've measured, if we just take baby boomers and isolate them, and how many real estate projects have baby boomers as their primary target audience? There's countless. That seems to be, for the last 20 years, that's our favorite target audience. Baby boomers only agree on any of those 380 things 15% of the time. Sorry, 13% of the time for baby boomers. That means 87% of the time baby boomers disagree on everything that it means to be alive and human. So how can you spend money targeting baby boomers when you know you're only getting a 13% ROI on every dollar and every hour that you use trying to get into their heads? Millennials, as another example, they're the ones that agree with each other only 15% of the time. And we're supposed to change the world for the millennials, for Pete's sakes. Nothing's good enough for the millennials. And the millennials only agree with each other 15% of the time. That's not even really a target audience. That's a really terrible ROI. If I've got a buck to spend and I only get 15% of my audience activated. But if we use values as a way to motivate and understand our audiences and try and engage with them better, we can get those numbers around how often they agree with each other on all those things up in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
And that goes across all the demographic age groups, right?
all the demographic age groups, gender. We talk about age very specifically because it's an easy one for people to get their heads around. Most things start with an age thing. But those low numbers, like in the low teens, they hold true for how much people are similar to each other within gender categories, within wealth categories, within education categories. All the demographic labels are the same. Hardly any agreement, any similarity amongst the people in those categories whatsoever. But if you look at those same audiences and say, what are their shared values? Then we see alignment around all these 380 different things that we've measured. They're up in the 70s, 80s, 90s. So again, just to make this silly little comparison, if you've got a dollar to spend and you target people demographically with that dollar, based on the demographic stereotypes we're all incredibly familiar with, you're going to get a 10, 11, 12, 13, 14% return on investment on that dollar. If you just change the way you look at your audience, you don't have to buy anything, you don't have to install any kind of new technology, just change the way you look at the world. And suddenly, you're going to get that dollars returning 70, 80, 90% in terms of how much these folks will pay attention to whatever it is you're trying to get them to do.
It seems like it's a better approach because if a developer is already designing a project to meet the needs of these different demographics that they think are interested in that particular urban experience, using the values approach is going to just broaden the appeal of the property to different numbers of people.
Oh, absolutely. It's going to broaden the net, and it's going to actually be spending the money in a more responsible way. Let me give you a quick example as it relates to specifically to real estate. There's this myth out there that somehow younger people are more interested in technology and more familiar and happy using technology, and older people, I don't want to say where the cutoff is for what's young and what's old, but let's say older people in general somehow are scared of technology and don't know how to use it, and it's not their friend. Well, our data is saying that's absolutely false, that there's people across both sets that were just talked about there, just age-based sets, who are equally comfortable with technology and people who are very uncomfortable with technology. So if you put in some technology and you figure that's limiting yourself to just one age category or another, or you remove all the technology because you think that's going to limit yourself to one category or another, you're wrong. There's a slice. Think of it this way. There's this loaf of bread called your audience. And we've been slicing it like we've always sliced that loaf of bread based on age and gender and income and all these other categories, these demographic labels. But instead, if we slice the bread the long way instead of the short way, we can find similar groups across all of those categories that are going to be motivated by those values far more than the demographic stereotypes that we're using with the short slices of bread.
It makes so much sense. It really does.
It's kind of a slap yourself in the forehead. What were those TV? It was a V8 moment. You're sort of saying to yourself, well, you know what? Nobody really acts their age anymore. We run around saying 70 is the new 50 and 60 is the new 40. We understand that we don't have to behave the way we used to have to behave at a certain age. There's no social pressure to be married at a certain age anymore. Get promoted at a certain age. If you're a rich guy, you don't really behave any differently than if you're a middle class guy. But we still use all of those categories to somehow try and understand who we're talking to and what's going to motivate them as if they make sense. It's like we lose our minds when we walk back into the boardroom and all the rules we know about in the real world somehow don't apply when you're in the boardroom, because we need to come up with some kind of description for who it is we're talking to. Well, now we can use values as a way to describe who we're talking to, instead of demographic stereotypes that just don't make sense anymore.
David Allison is the author of When Shopping Centers Become Vertical Villages, a new report based on his proprietary predictive behavior database, Value Graphics. You can get more information at valuegraphics.com. David's latest book, We Are All the Same Age Now, is an Inc. magazine top leadership book of the year. David, thanks very much for explaining it to us and for joining us on the program.
I'm so glad I had an opportunity to chat. Thanks so much, Steve.
You're listening to the CRE News Hour. I'm Steve Lubetkin. Following several crises over the past several years, Puerto Rico's lodging market seems to be poised for a comeback. JLL has released a report, Puerto Rico Hotel Destinations, which describes how hotels across the Caribbean island have come back online after renewed capital investments, economic incentives, and strategic efforts of the government of Puerto Rico and the U.S. government. Air capacity to the island will increase in 2019 for the first time since 2016, and to meet the demand by 2020, about 2,400 hotel rooms are going to be reintroduced to the market, along with more than 850 new rooms currently under development. With us is Andrew Dickey, who is an executive vice president with JLL and the author of the report about some of the things that people are not really aware of in terms of the island's recovery. Andrew, thanks for joining us on the CRE NewsHour.
Of course. Good to hear from you, Steve.
We are looking at a comeback in the Puerto Rican hospitality market. You have a new report out about it. Tell me what's going on there. What are you finding, and what are the things that people need to know about the hotels?
Yeah, so Puerto Rico as a market has been, you know, it's been hit by two main factors on the lodging side if we look over the last few years. First was Zika, right? A major impact in the lodging space. Obviously, a lot of that was media driven and less actuality of what ended up happening. And then the other was obviously Hurricane Maria, which was almost 20 year anniversary from their last major Hurricane George in, I guess, 20 years prior. That being said, the lodging market has been extremely stable, and it's one of the most stable lodging markets in the United States. Although there's a lot of stigma after Hurricane and Zika of its and obviously economic position that have impacted the lodging market or perception of the lodging market, when in reality it's actually performing very well.
You know, most people are looking at Puerto Rico and they're saying, you know, devastated by Maria, infrastructure questionable, and maybe not some place that I would be focusing on right now. What do you say in response to that kind of perception? Is the infrastructure stable enough that it makes sense for people to consider going back there again?
100%. And people have been coming back already. As of February of 2019, the U.S. Federal government distributed about $11.1 billion of the $15.5 billion allocated for FEMA. So a bunch of that has already been deployed from that perspective, from infrastructure and those type of projects. By the end of this year, the total aid will be around $21 billion. So there's been quite a bit spent already on infrastructure. That being said, Puerto Rico prior was you know, infrastructure-wise, was actually very strong. Obviously, media and things, there's power grid and some of those issues. But from a lodging perspective, from a guest perspective, nothing here that would cause any alarm, I guess, from a traveler's perspective.
In your report, you talk about some of the advantages that Puerto Rico has, one of which is that it's highly accessible to people wanting to go there, and also it has some tax advantages for investors from the U.S. and from foreign locations. Talk about those.
Sure. So, it is the most accessible Caribbean island, and so airlift in the lodging sector is the most critical point when looking at lodging. So with the most airlift, it's continued to have strong lift. It's going to have one of its stronger years that it's had in the last 5 years in 2019. That being said, you also have cruise passengers, which has been exponential. They've had a great year. So we're seeing a lot of rebound on the airline side and the cruise side. In regards to investor appetite, in regards to tax exemptions, those type of things, there's a lot going on in Puerto Rico. One of the biggest is qualified opportunity zones. A majority of the island does qualify. And so here's an example of, in the U.S. we have qualified zones, but in Puerto Rico, it's a multiplier on your return. Because there's a lot of tax exemptions relative to the property tax, call it roughly 90%. There's 100% exemption on municipal construction and sales tax when you're building a project. And then also a lot of your reinvested capital, which is a big part of qualified opportunity zones, right? You have to put in more than you've purchased. you can get a 30 to 40% tax credit up front. So there is quite a bit from the investor's perspective that is not, I think, is not fully understood. But investors are becoming more and more educated on Puerto Rico as an investment market. And we're seeing that in liquidity in the last 24 months.
You also write about the extent of the damage from Hurricane Maria to some of the key hospitality properties in Puerto Rico. And you talk about how the new properties are complementing the existing stock. What is going on in terms of hotel development? Is it continuing to grow? Is it going to be bigger than before? Or do people need to focus first on restoring the damaged properties?
Yeah, so as a result of Maria, roughly 3,200 hotel rooms were lost. And I say lost, not completely gone, but just in some sort of non-operable capacity. By 2020, we anticipate about 2,400 of those rooms to be reintroduced to the market. And so there's two real dynamics here. One, if you look at Puerto Rico over the last 20 years, there hasn't been a lot of supply added. And then we will also likely lost quite a bit of supply from Hurricane Maria. So as a result, here's a market, and we're running through this with a lot of the major markets in the United States, supply driven. It's one of the biggest impactors in the lodging business. And when you look at a market that's been performing very well for a long period of time, with limited supply and very limited supply coming in, it can be very attractive from the investment side. So this is where we think we're going to start to see liquidity from investors looking at Puerto Rico as a very investable market, because it doesn't have the supply issues that some of the other markets have experienced. And again, part of that is the result of Maria.
As you talk to your clients, what are the points of advice you're giving them about how they should position their plans if they're thinking about investing in the hospitality sector or any of the other sectors in Puerto Rico? What are you telling them that they should be looking for?
So there's a stigma that is, that the hospitality segment is, and included in all segments of Puerto Rico. It could be correlated directly to the economic issues that the general market and Puerto Rico in general is having. The reality is 89% of the visitors to Puerto Rico are from the mainland U.S. So when you look at the lodging segment, you're basically leasing rooms every night to tenants. In theory, your tenants are almost 90% are from the U.S. And that's, kind of, if you look at on the real estate side, when you look at the creditworthiness of your tenant, whether that's in retail, office, in hotels, it changes every night, your tenant base, but 90% of the origin is from the mainland U.S. So I think that's a big selling point that says, hey, from an economic perspective, you're not taking local market risk when investing in the lodging side of Puerto Rico. The reality is you're taking mainland you're looking at the risk of your tenants, which are from the mainland U.S. And that's a big selling point, I think, for investors to understand the lodging space relative to other segments or other industries within Puerto Rico.
Andrew Dickey is an executive vice president with JLL in Miami. Andrew, thanks for joining us on the CRE NewsHour podcast.
Perfect, Steve. Appreciate it.
We'll post a link to the JLL report, which is called Puerto Rico Hotel Destinations Report, on the show notes page for this podcast at statebroadcastnews.com. We'll be back in a minute.
Shalom. This is Rabbi Richard Address. Join us for our podcast series from Jewish Sacred Aging entitled Seekers of Meaning. We'll explore some of the issues and events that impact ourselves, our families, and our Jewish world at large in light of the current revolution in aging.
The Seekers of Meaning podcast airs every Friday morning at 8 a.m. at JewishSacredAging.com. Today, you can't wait for the media to cover your company. You have to be the media. Take advantage of the power of audio and video. It's the best way to showcase your expertise to prospective customers. Let the Lubetkin Media Companies handle the technical side. We're award-winning audio and video producers. We can help you produce podcasts and video programs remotely or in our fully equipped studio in Cherry Hill. Visit beingthemedia.com for more information. As one of the only women brokers and developers in the New York metropolitan region, Heidi Burkhart, the president and founder of affordable housing brokerage firm Dane Real Estate, has become a staple in New York City's affordable housing industry. Over the course of an 11-year career at Dane, she's facilitated the closing of tens of thousands of affordable housing units and generated more than $2 billion in transactions. In 2019 alone, Heidi's closed 15 deals. She founded the firm at just age 26. She's become perhaps more well-known for her advocacy efforts for affordable housing, including raising awareness and educating politicians, residents, and others about its benefits. She's appeared on local television and talked about affordable housing in Forbes, The Huffington Post, Crain's, City Limits, and The Real Deal, among other regional and trade publications. Heidi, welcome to the CRE NewsHour.
Thank you so much. I'm happy to be here.
So you founded your own brokerage firm in 2008, I think it was. Why did you set up your own firm and what made you focus on affordable housing in the New York metro area?
Yeah, so I actually came here in 2002 when I turned 20 in Stanford, and then I started in real estate in 2001. I was actually at another brokerage company for a while. Working from there from 2003 when I turned 21 to 2008 is basically the time from that I was at Eastern Consolidated. And, you know, from that 10 years when I actually specialized in affordable housing. And then 2008, just from the luck of having great friends and peers in the business and mentors, someone like Deborah Van Amerongen and Adam Silfen, Charlie Gendron and Scott Jaffe, they all pushed me to want to start my own company as they saw better growth for me. And, you know, I was pretty naive at the time, being only 26. So I was lucky to have such strong friends and peers and mentors in the business that saw something more in me. Because at 26, you know, I was pretty humbled by then after, you know, my first 3 years of making only $5,000, basically my first 3 years each year. So that humbled me pretty fast. So, you know, having people then say that, you know, you could do better and do more. That's how I actually started my own company. And then from there, I, you know, stayed with my niche of affordable housing that I developed at Eastern and just kept on trying to grow that. You know, it took me a while to understand how to manage people. You know, that's always something that I'm happy to talk about because I think there's ups and downs in that regard. But, you know, at this point, 10 years later, basically, or actually almost 11 years, it's been, you know, I finally feel settled. We're seeing a lot of growth. There's been a lot of ups and downs, but, you know, from now it's been pretty exponential in regards to the growth that we're seeing. So it's pretty cool to see, you know, how we've grown and just niching in affordable housing. And we branch off a little bit from there. But my big thing is, you know, making sure you start a company and me trying to advocate more, you can actually have a company that does really good for the community and still make money. Because a lot of people always think you have to be a nonprofit, which hats off to nonprofits. You know, from my standpoint, I wouldn't want all that regulation because I think it constrains you and restrains you from, you know, time-wise opportunity cost. So I'm happy that, you know, a lot of nonprofits exist, but I also think that there's ways to do good for the community and make money as well as then give back to those nonprofits, you know, once you are established as a for-profit company too.
What was it that made you focus on affordable housing? That seems to be important to you. You've done a lot of rehabilitation of properties in the Bronx and Brooklyn, Staten Island, New Jersey. You've worked with Section 8 housing. Why is that something that attracted you?
The people. You know, it's an industry where a handshake is still honorable. You know, the affordable housing industry is just a lot of good-hearted, hardworking people that are really doing it for the tenants. You know, there's agencies, you know, people that work at agencies, they're absolutely amazing individuals and that they work hard as well, you know, and they don't make as much money as developers, but they still have a huge heart in regards to what they're doing and advocating. And, you know, and then the developers just, again, they're doing it for the tenants. Yeah, there's money involved, but there's a lot of other ways to make money. And, you know, your reputation in affordable housing is everything. So if you're not a good person, you're not going to stay in it. So why I say that is it's still the old school way of just a handshake means a deal's done. And I think that's what drew me to it, especially coming from Ohio and having those Midwest values. You know, it's something that New York would have gobbled me up. Not saying that people don't honor handshakes. It's just a little different in doing business here versus somewhere like Ohio. You know, and affordable housing kind of felt like home to me. And then, you know, the other side of it after, you know, I was pretty naive again when I started getting into affordable housing, not really realizing, you know, how much it created a community. But as I got older, you know, at 37, I sit back and I see how amazing the tenants are within affordable housing. And, you know, having a good home is extremely important. So being able to be a part of, you know, a transition from a property that can't necessarily cash flow to do repairs to having a developer come in and do a tax credit execution and rehab the whole property and maintain affordable housing and preserving the units. You know, it's pretty awesome to see, you know, just the mental state that, you know, a tenant has a new home and a new beginning, a new life, because there's extremely brilliant people that live in affordable housing. And, you know, people always have a stereotype when you talk about it, but it's the exact opposite. You have extremely hardworking, very family oriented, you know, smart, beautiful, you know, people within housing. And I think it's one of those things I constantly want to have it shine. You know, again, as I talked about before, my big thing is trying to show that you can do good by, you know, still have profit, make profit by doing good for the community. And, you know, it's one of those things that even just talking to the tenants and working in different ways and different facets, you know, and mentoring, you know, it kind of stems off everything. But long story short, you know, the industry is just an amazing industry.
Under the current administration, there have been proposals and some efforts to roll back affordable housing development programs and things like that. And there's been some indication that housing and urban development hasn't made the best choices in terms of some places like Puerto Rico, where hurricane relief was stymied. What's your take? Has the situation become more challenging under the current administration, or is it more window dressing?
The latter, just because there's always opportunity when you look at things. It's just looking at where the opportunity lies. You know, if one state is more Democratic versus Republic, then you're looking probably that they're going to be more heavy on tax credit developers being in that market. And a Republican state, then you have the cash buyers that are very heavy on estate holds and preserving affordable housing and creating cash flow rather than a tax credit that is fee-based. There's always opportunities in regards to, you know, creating affordable housing. Puerto Rico, for instance, I believe the whole country is an opportunity zone, which, you know, I just think it's hard to get people there. You know, I don't think it's the government. I really think it's just developers don't necessarily want to go there because there's so many other places in the contiguous, like the U.S. to go in, you know, unfortunately. So I think that maybe there should be better incentives to get back to Puerto Rico, which definitely was devastated. And I would love to see that. You know, we've been trying to sell a property there probably for 2 years, and it's just hard to get people's attention. You know, I keep on joking that we should talk to A-Rod and J-Lo because maybe they'll take it for the lesser returns. And I wish they would reach out to us. But, you know, that's, to me, it's hard to get someone invested in Puerto Rico. And to me, it's silly, but it's just the way it is. And then in regards to, you know, government agencies, they're so creative. You know, it's just different ways and different mayors or different presidential candidates, you know, look at different things in regards to affordable housing. You know, I think that, you know, the attention to preserving so many units in the city, being New York City, is great. Same time, I do think that there was too much focus on homeless and low income. Reason being that we definitely need homeless and low income, but we also need stepping stones, and there's not enough middle income housing. And, you know, the new regulations, I think, were horrible. You know, I don't think you can put government control on a business that's already been established. I think you need to create new housing. Because I think when you do the rent regulations on existing product, now it's going to hurt in regards to repairing the building systems, being the roof, the boiler, the windows, versus when you can build new and it's a better product. So I think the lack of focus on actually giving stepping stones to people that are homeless and low income to get to middle and out of affordable housing, you know, I think is what we need to do. You know, I think we stunt people's growth when we just give them homeless and low income. Like, where else are they supposed to go? If they make more money, they lose their housing. Why would you want to make more money? You know, for, you know, going from, let's just say, 600, then all of a sudden, if you make more money, you're going to go to 1800 to over 2000 in New York City. Who wants to do that? So it's one of those things. I think we stunt our community's growth and actually just looking at homeless and low income. Because if you can get people out of low income to middle, then you have more units for the homeless and low income to go into. You know, it's kind of one of those things that you want to show a growth, not stunning someone's growth.
A few minutes ago, you mentioned the difference between predominantly Democratic states and predominantly Republican states in terms of their willingness to offer tax incentive financing or tax breaks for developers. What other trends are you seeing nationwide as you look at affordable housing? What areas are better positioned to deal with affordable housing versus the ones that aren't?
Yeah, it's one of those that's hard. You know, when I look nationally, when you're looking at more rural areas, that affordable housing will hurt more because the rents don't grow as fast as somewhere like New York City or Chicago or LA. So, you know, when you have in the urban markets, there's more of a need for, I shouldn't say there's more of a need. There's more growth potential for a business structure for affordable housing. When you're looking at rural, it's just, you don't get that growth, right? It's just more steady in regards to your return where you don't get the huge increases of rents. For the affordable housing. So it's just a different model when you're looking at, you know, cities and states from a rural and urban perspective. When you're looking at, you know, the politics of things, you know, it's kind of, again, that's why I think it's been, and it took me a while to understand how much the Senate and House is very important for you to vote on. And even just your mayor and your district attorney. You know, I think people forget that it really starts, you know, within the city and the federal government, you know, is definitely one aspect, but I think it's more important to look at what your city and state do. You know, New Jersey under Christie definitely was not doing tax credit deals, which really stunted the affordable housing growth to a certain degree. Not since it stunted the growth, it stunted the tax credit developers to do huge rehabs on properties to, you know, to purchase and acquire, you know, and sometimes those are better for, you know, the housing because then the whole building needs to have a huge renovation. And sometimes that's better for the asset. It doesn't mean it's the only way. Again, there's cash buyers, but, you know, it's just different, you know, and as everything cycles through, it's just different cycles. And I don't think any one of them's better, to be honest with you. It just really depends on who the owner is. And, you know, the agencies work extremely hard to be creative and making sure there's preservation in places like New York. Because it's more people needing it, I guess. Same time again, everywhere needs it. Everywhere needs more middle income, you know, families, even low income for a certain part of it. But again, I just think we're really missing on the middle income and workforce housing more so than anything, you know. But yeah, it's hard to say, you know, what trends there are politically, you know, in that regard. You know, tax credits can always be bought. I think that there needs to be more corporations, such as, you know, Amazon, Facebook, Ford, you know, basic companies within your city that should be investing in tax credits and affordable housing deals, which there aren't. Usually it's the banks that everybody gets mad at, but the banks are the ones that actually have been the ones that bought a lot of the tax credits for affordable housing to preserve affordable housing because of their CRA credits. But, you know, so it's kind of funny in that regard that the banks were actually the ones that were preserving when everybody got mad at them. In regards to preserving housing, but I think there needs to be more corporations that invest, and maybe it's the city talking to more corporations that are big in their area to, you know, buy the tax credits. Maybe they just don't know. Maybe they're not educated in it. So, you know, I think that's an area that needs to be more looked at, Republican or Democrat. You know, Republican, it could be great because then they attract more corporations and more jobs, you know, in a different way through tax credits or, you know, tax incentives. I think things are blended on a political standpoint right now between Republican, Democrat. I think people waver both ways, you know, so maybe they're more fiscally Republican, socially Democrat, or vice versa. I think it's just more educating, you know, the different incentives because it gets confusing. And when things get confusing, then people just want to shut off and they don't try to understand it.
Is the Federal Opportunity Zone program having any direct impact on decisions that people make about affordable housing, or is that just sort of a sideshow sidebar to the typical affordable housing?
People are still trying to understand opportunity zones. So I think that's the number one issue. It's kind of in like this weird place of what exactly is it? What are the exact incentives that we have that will result from it? That being said, I do see a lot of people that have been more focused in areas that I've never seen them in regards to investing. And, you know, we're getting some deals, some places like how in regards to Houston or Miami that are large developments that I don't think people would have looked at as residential affordable housing developments. But now since it's an OZ zone and there's a lot of equity that's focused on OZ zones, they're getting a lot of attention now. So, and it's in areas that aren't prime Miami or aren't prime Houston, Texas, but you know, it's pretty cool to see that people actually want to actually invest there for that reason. I think it's a program that works better on ground up, which I'm actually excited for because I think that's where, you know, we need to build more middle income housing versus having like how we have here in New York City, the rent regulation program, which I think is horrible. Again, for my reason, you're not going to be able to renovate the building as, you know, they bought it as. They're not going to put the money back in because they don't, there's no cash flow as they were expecting to put back in the building. I think we need to create ground up. So I'm pretty excited to be a part of those two developments in Houston and Miami for creating more middle income and, you know, better housing that it's ground up, new housing for tenants and middle income families and workforce housing families. I think it's some areas, sure, it's kind of still questionable. But I think it was actually a good program personally. I think it's creative of the agencies to think of something like that. It's great to see that it's constantly in progression on how do we create more housing in areas that need it and fill in the holes and the gaps to create diversity. You know, I think, again, that the agencies do a great job in trying to be on the forefront and creative. You know, I hats off to them in regards to always trying to be progressive.
Is the economy going to stay relatively positive, or are we looking for some bumps along the way in the next couple of years?
You know, I think, again, without taking any political stance at all, so it's not me taking any political stance and where I sit, just being realistic about things. If Trump doesn't get reelected in 2020, I think there'll be a huge, huge shakeup. Because as anything, if there's change, there's always a shakeup. And if it goes to Democrat or more progressive, whoever is a Democratic candidate, we don't know quite yet. But that will shake up corporations completely. The stock market will definitely feel that. And then stock market is more perception, I think, at times than actual economy per se. But if the stock market starts crashing in some kind of fashion, people will freak out. And I think that would happen. If Trump gets reelected, you know, socially, I think it's not the best situation. But in regards to fiscally, I think that corporation will still stay strong and the economy will stay strong. And people's reassurance that, you know, there'll still be growth, I think, will be there. So again, there's pluses and minuses to everything, pros and cons, but I definitely, you know, I think that next year being election year is a huge year. You know, it's kind of, it always is. You know, we've had deals that have been shaky every single time when there's a new election, and affordable housing deals take about 9 months to a year and a half to close. So if you're in that midst of an election year, it definitely gets shaky. Every single time. So even when, you know, Obama was elected or, you know, Obama to Trump, it's always just kind of one of those shaky periods. So again, I think a lot depends on the 2020 election and even within your own community, you know, in regards to like how will taxes be seen? Will people want to stay within the community to live there? You know, I think New York City faces that a lot is, you know, we have such high taxes. Everybody wants to live outside of New York City, which is so frustrating to me when, you know, it's such a great city, but no one wants to claim it as home because it's too unaffordable versus other places they can live. You know, I always joke that if New Jersey dropped their state taxes or city taxes at zero, that they probably would get influx of people just moving there. Comically, I say that just because people want to live here in New York City, but we definitely make it unaffordable at times. So, you know, crystal ball wise, I always see opportunity. It's the only way that you can be as an entrepreneur. You know, it's just kind of where is the opportunity and where do you go to grab it and where do you go to create it? So, you know, it's kind of on the forefront of, you know, next year is going to be definitely a funky year and just kind of figuring out, okay, if it goes this way, here's what we're going to do. If it goes this way, this is what we're going
to
do.
We'll have to check back with you if and when the cycle changes.
Definitely. Well, I thank you so much for that too. So, you know, anytime that you ever need anybody, we're always here.
Thank you. Heidi Burkhardt is president and founder of affordable housing brokerage firm Dane Real Estate. She's based in New York City. And that'll wrap things up for this edition of the CRE News Hour. You can send your comments, suggestions, and story ideas to Steve at statebroadcastnews.com or you can leave an audio comment for us using the voicemail icon on the homepage at statebroadcastnews.com. And we tape this program in Studio A at State Broadcast News in Cherry Hill, New Jersey. Join us again for the next episode of the CRE News Hour next Friday at 8 a.m. Eastern Time at statebroadcastnews.com or wherever you get your podcasts. This is Steve Lubetkin. We'll see you out there on the net. Take good care.